This is Reaction. Movements, moments, and monsters of the reactionary right. The John Birch Society, Part 3. What then must we do? The United States is a republic, not a democracy. So goes the John Birch Society maxim. Robert Welch was vocal about not caring for democracy, calling it in the Blue Book merely a deceptive phrase, a weapon of demagoguery, and a perennial fraud. When the plebs get out of line, start demanding too much in the form of state assistance or the right to organize their workplace or justice, things go off the rails. What was needed was the leadership of strong, dedicated, pro-American men, and they would be men. Men like Robert Taft, Joseph McCarthy, and Douglas MacArthur. But one by one, his heroes were thwarted, maybe even killed, by the communist conspiracy. Even the highest echelons of government were culpable. Even the Supreme Court. Welch called Brown v. Board of Education the most brazen and flagrant usurpation of power that has been seen in any major court in the whole Anglo-American system of jurisprudence in 300 years. But it wasn't just Brown v. Board. He cited the 1956 Pennsylvania v. Nelson case, which resulted in a mistrial of a man convicted of sedition under state law. The court argued that the federal sedition law superseded the state law. Steve Nelson was a confirmed member of the Communist Party. Then there was Konigsberg v. State Bar, 1957, in which the Committee of Bar Examiners of California denied Raphael Konigsberg the ability to practice law in the state due to his failure to prove that he was of good moral character and did not advocate the forcible overthrow of the government. When asked by the committee if he was a communist, Konigsberg refused to answer. The Supreme Court ruled that refusal to answer the question was insufficient reason to deny admission to the bar, and he was eventually allowed to practice. Then there was Watkins v. United States, in which a labor organizer was convicted of contempt of Congress for refusing to answer questions before the House Committee on Un-American Activities. The committee demanded that Watkins give up the names of members of the Communist Party, which he declined to do. The Supreme Court ruled that Congress had no constitutional jurisdiction to compel people to answer questions about their private lives. Welch also took issue with Sweezy v. New Hampshire. Paul Sweezy was a Marxist economist and was subpoenaed by the New Hampshire Attorney General to attest to his connections with socialists and communists, as well as the content of a lecture he had given at the University of New Hampshire. The Attorney General was not too happy about all this dialectical materialism stuff. Sweezy refused and was found in contempt of court until the Supreme Court ruled that the whole affair was a violation of due process. Welch blamed one man for the tyranny of the court and the ongoing destruction of American values, Chief Justice Earl Warren. Warren was protecting communists and attempting to turn the republic into a democracy. The National Review agreed, asking why the Kremlin would need a fifth column in the United States so long as the Supreme Court is determined to be so helpful. Rosalie Gordon's book, Nine Men Against America, The Supreme Court and Its Attack on American Liberties, had inspired Welch's crusade against Warren, and the JBS reprinted the book, sending it to chapters across the country. Welch believed that if the society could get a million Americans to read Nine Men Against America, that Warren's impeachment would follow as shortly and swiftly as children dash for an open box of candy. JBS members were urged to write to their representatives in Congress, imploring them to impeach Justice Warren, and the society sponsored an essay writing contest for undergraduates with a cash prize of $2,500. They paid for roadside billboards calling for the impeachment. The whole effort was futile, and Welch knew it from the start, but it gave members something to do, an outlet for the pent-up energy they had. This was the society's first major campaign, but it was far from their last. Then came the 1960 election, and the consummate conservative, the savior of the movement, the new man upon whom hopes and dreams could be pinned, Barry Goldwater. The frontrunners of the primary election were unacceptable to conservatives. Richard Nixon, whom Welch called one of the ablest, shrewdest, most disingenuous, and slipperiest politicians that ever showed up on the American scene, and Nelson Rockefeller, the personification of everything that was wrong with the Eastern establishment. And so, many conservatives decided that it was time to establish a third party. Thus was born the 1959 New Party Rally, at which 1,000 conservatives, including Robert Welch, William F. Buckley, radio host Dan Smoot, and Secretary of the States Rights Party of Louisiana Medford Evans, gathered to organize an amalgam of local conservative third parties. Held in Chicago, the goal of the rally attendees was to get a third party on the ballot in 30 states for the 1960 election. They passed measures for repealing the personal income tax, reining in the power of the Supreme Court, protecting states' rights, passing the Bricker Amendment, eliminating foreign aid, abolishing Social Security, and outlawing the Communist Party. And they knew their man, Arizona Senator Barry Goldwater. The only problem was, he wasn't interested in running. Other possible candidates included the pro-segregation South Carolina Senator Strom Thurmond, McCarthyist Indiana Senator William Jenner, and Dan Smoot. The rally was a bust, but it did yield the Draft Goldwater Organization founded by Clarence Mannion. Mannion was a dear friend of Robert Welch, the former dean of the Notre Dame Law School, a member of the JBS National Council, and an influential conservative leader in his own right. He had a huge impact on Robert's political beliefs, and he wasn't ready to give up on the idea of a third party led by Goldwater. This, too, failed in the short term, but it would lay the groundwork for 1964. But rifts were beginning to emerge between Mannion and Welch, specifically thanks to Welch trying to use the Draft Goldwater campaign to recruit for the JBS. This was a common complaint about Welch. He was ruthless in his recruiting and not above hijacking other causes to grow the organization. While for Mannion, organizations like the JBS and publications like the National Review were a means to an end, getting a conservative legislature and a conservative president, for Welch, it often seemed that JBS was the end. Educating the public, getting them to join grassroots efforts, these were the goals of his conservatism, and this chicken and egg problem created a great deal of tension in the society. Still, the men held many principles in common and shared similar goals, so the two continued to work together, and the synergy they created would propel the movement forward. Book distribution wasn't just the wheelhouse of the JBS. Mannion arranged for Buckley's brother-in-law, L. Brent Bozell, to ghostwrite Barry Goldwater's The Conscience of a Conservative, which introduced millions of Americans to the conservative movement and brought Goldwater national attention. Other JBS members would also pick up the Goldwater banner. Welch himself urged society members to write to Goldwater expressing their support for him. Unfortunately, Goldwater didn't share the same fondness for Welch. He lobbied society leaders to cut ties with him, telling one council member, "Remove Bob Welch and the society cannot be attacked." In the end, Goldwater did not run, and the Republican candidate Richard Nixon lost to John F. Kennedy. This was the worst possible outcome for conservatives. Nixon may have been slippery, a fake conservative, an opportunist, a fox in the henhouse, but Kennedy was an outright communist. According to Welch, "The new administration, far more openly than any that have preceded it, will be working for the same things, most of the same things, as the international communists, and that the results will include the total surrender of the independence of the United States." Kennedy was just as worried about the JBS as they were about him. The organization and other ultra-conservatives were receiving increased scrutiny from the mainstream press, especially for their tactics, which often mirrored those of the communists, infiltrating PTAs, establishing front groups, and working in the shadows of other, more respectable institutions. And the conspiracy was growing. Popular culture was softening the American public, turning it against the possibility of a necessary nuclear war. Arms control was a communist plot. The Council on Foreign Relations was going to hand the U.S. nuclear arsenal over to the UN and integrate the U.S. into the USSR. With Castro in control of Cuba, it was only a matter of time before the Soviets placed nukes off the coast of Florida. It's worth noting that Phyllis Schlafly made the same point, and Robert Welch called her a very loyal member of the John Birch Society. You can hear more about Schlafly's possible entanglement with the Society for just a dollar at patreon.com/reactionpodcast. Regardless of whether or not she was really a member, her vehement denial of the connection goes to show how radical the JBS was. Even the sweetheart of the conservative movement wanted nothing to do with it, at least publicly. Then came the disaster that was the Bay of Pigs. The attempted invasion of Cuba resulted in 106 deaths on the American side. Welch argued that Castro had emerged far stronger than ever, not only having put down a revolt, but as the communist David who had defeated the great capitalist Goliath. And, of course, it was all done on purpose. It had been planned to fail from its very inception. Washington had cooperated with Castro, a charge which Kennedy directly addressed in a press conference regarding the Bay of Pigs. He said that the Society was oversimplifying the communist problem, seeking solutions and safety in a complicated and dangerous world. Meanwhile, Kennedy's electoral victory and the flub of the Bay of Pigs spurred the Society's growth. Welch claimed the JBS was doubling its membership every 4 months. This despite the fact that the media sought to quash them. He wrote, "Having used the period of 1951 to 1956 to destroy Joe McCarthy, the media set out exactly 10 years later with several times as much force, falsehood, and determination to destroy the Society." In 1961, both the conservative Los Angeles Times and Time magazine launched attacks against the JBS, particularly their secrecy, Welch's dictatorial style, their extreme paranoia, and their mimicking of communist tactics. Time argued that the Society was barely a goose step away from the formation of goon squads, and called the politician Welch's Mein Kampf. Worker columnist Mike Newberry published a 47-page pamphlet called The Fascist Revival, The Inside Story of the John Birch Society, which argued that the number of military men in society leadership heralded a Nazi-style takeover of American democracy. You can hear a few excerpts from The Fascist Revival by supporting the show at patreon.com/reactionpodcast. The comparison to Hitler wasn't limited to the newspapers. FDR's son, John Roosevelt, called the Society an un-American organization with incipient Hitler-like tendencies. Republican Senator from North Dakota Milton Young criticized the JBS from the halls of Congress, accusing Welch of aping Hitler and using the tactics Hitler used on his road to power. Even Kennedy implied the resemblance. But the charges of Nazism, which in my opinion were overstated, JBS showed no inclination toward violence, and the racism and anti-Semitism were more a matter of casual connection than stringent internal ideology. But the charges only reinforced the Society's belief that they were a beleaguered minority of freedom fighters in a world overcome by communist conspiracy. The only thing worse than being called a communist was being called a Nazi, and the fact that powerful entities were making the charge proved just how much Americanism was under assault. And nothing fuels a conspiracist more than repression. But it wasn't going to be so easy to beat the charges of anti-Semitism the Society faced. Welch knew these accusations were damaging the organization and even tried to pull the "some of my best friends are Jewish" card, which was true. He had a lot of Jewish acquaintances and colleagues, particularly through his business relationships. Nonetheless, there were good reasons to associate the Society with anti-Jewish beliefs. People may have thought Robert Welch ruled the JBS with an iron fist, but it was his very inability to rein in members that would lead to some of the most powerful discrediting. When Slobodan Draskovich, a member of the National Council and frequent peddler of racist pseudoscience, wrote an article for American Opinion that fighting the Nazis had been a mistake, that U.S. involvement in World War II had made communism stronger, The press attacked. It was a deeply unpopular opinion, seen as downright unpatriotic. World War II had been the good war, an unimpeachable intervention against the most evil forces the world had ever seen. Of course, as an America firster, Welch had himself opposed intervention, but that didn't make it any easier to say publicly on a national platform. And then there were the out-and-out anti-Semites Robert continued to associate with, such as Russell McGuire, who used the infamous anti-Semitic tract The Protocols of the Elders of Zion in his editorials for his magazine American Mercury. He also allowed other anti-Semites to publish in the pages of American Opinion. He maintained correspondence with the notorious Vern Kaub and painted his differences with anti-Semites as friendly disagreements, writing, "It is my very deep-rooted intention to try to work on just as friendly terms as I possibly can with every good patriot in this country who is honestly and truly opposed to the communist advance and willing to stand up and fight against that advance, despite whatever other characteristics any such person might have with which I would not be in sympathy." As if whether or not the Jews are heading up an international conspiracy to enslave the world was as innocuous as a debate over foreign policy in Korea. Furthermore, was Welch's preoccupation with the unfair treatment of the Nazis and Germans at large during and after the war. In The Politician, he accused Eisenhower of trying to turn Germany into a goat pasture so that it could never stand as a bulwark against the eventual Russian march across Europe. He called the evidence used in the Nuremberg trials one-sided. Welch also dabbled in conspiracy theory surrounding the protocols. The document is now well known to be a hoax, but Robert believed it to be a hoax of a different kind. Rather than something cooked up by the right wing, Welch believed that Lenin or some of his followers had written the document to discredit anti-communists. Agent provocateurs were planting these anti-Semitic ideas within the conservative movement, and particularly the JBS, to discredit it. There were certain anti-Semites who were even a little too radical for the very forgiving Robert Welch, such as former Hitlerite and Christian nationalist Harold L.K. Smith. Welch believed he was one such agent provocateur. He said that he was utterly unwilling to accept the thinking of those who assume that practically all Jews are communists and vice versa, and that nothing could be more ridiculous. Blaming the whole communist conspiracy today or in the past decade on the Jews is an extremely dangerous oversimplification of our problem. He cited anti-communist Jews such as William Schlamm and Alfred Kohlberg as proof that there were plenty of Jews dedicated to the cause. Which came first, the Jews or the communists, would continue to this day to be a dividing line within the ultra-conservative movement. All the while, the William F. Buckley wing of the conservative movement was increasingly critical of the JBS, though often indirectly so as not to alienate more moderate members of the society. When attacking the conspiratorial style of their counterparts, they made sure to zero in on Welch and acknowledge that many JBS members were perfectly reasonable and astute members of the conservative movement. Welch met this criticism with two defenses. First, that he had never called Eisenhower a card-carrying communist. This is simply quibbling. If he never used the words card-carrying, he heavily implied as much in The Politician. Second, he encouraged investigations into the society. He sent the monthly JBS bulletin to national newspapers. He tried to discredit the idea that they were a secret society by publishing the names of the National Council's members. He welcomed an investigation by the California Un-American Activities Subcommittee and the House Internal Security Subcommittee, both of which ultimately determined that the society was not a subversive fascist organization. He wrote in a 1961 edition of The Bulletin, "The John Birch Society does not seek publicity, but we have given up all hope of avoiding publicity, either good or bad." With this exposure came the revelation that Congressional Representatives Edgar Highstand and John Russolo were members. But what was the real effect of these investigations and the growing attention the society was receiving? Not all JBS opponents supported the scrutiny. For one, there was the risk of swelling their ranks by bringing them to greater prominence. Second, there was a whiff of hypocrisy and the fear that suppressing any political speech was a slippery slope. Senator Milton Young cautioned that it was legal for a man to be a fascist and to express opinions no matter how distorted, fantastic, and extreme they may be. The society also made its way into pop culture, appearing in the Bob Dylan song Talkin' John Birch Paranoid Blues. It went, in part, I got up in the morning and looked under my bed while I was looking everywhere for them gall-darned reds. Looked in the stove, behind the door, looked in the glove compartment of my car, couldn't find them. I was looking for them reds everywhere. I was looking in the sink and underneath the chair. I looked my way up my chimney hole. I even looked deep inside my toilet bowl. Well, I finally started thinking straight when I run out of things to investigate. Couldn't imagine doing anything else, so now I'm sitting home investigating myself. Hope I don't find out nothing. Good God. A similar parodic song was performed by the folk group The Chad Mitchell Trio, which became a surprise hit. There was an amusing coloring book published in 1962 that mocked the society's paranoia. In fact, many were coming to the conclusion that ridicule might be a more effective weapon against the society than official investigations or sincere engagement with their beliefs. Robert Kennedy called the JBS ridiculous and an organization that's in the area of being humorous. Cartoons cropped up in national papers, like the Washington Post's depiction of two figures, one representing the HUAC and the other the JBS, leaning in toward each other, whispering, "They're all communists except thee and me." The New Yorker published humorous articles about the society in April and May of 1961, stating that the fact of Eisenhower, Warren, and Dulles's communist intentions was great news because even with the executive and judicial branches of the government safely in their hands, communist agents were utterly unable to make their designs effective upon, or even apparent to, the rest of the nation. Apparently, America was able to absorb any number of such conspirators with no ill effects whatever. The New Yorker also ridiculed Welch's past as a candy manufacturer, low-hanging fruit if you ask me. And of course, all of this negative attention was proof positive that the society was the victim of a smear campaign orchestrated by none other than the Communist Party. Also out of California came a mixture of both ridicule and alarm, the Mosk Report. California Attorney General Stanley Mosk produced a report on the JBS that was meant to simply reflect his personal observations, though it was quickly treated by the public as the definitive, government-approved evaluation of the society. The 15-page report's first paragraph says it all. The cadre of the John Birch Society seems to be formed primarily of wealthy businessmen, retired military officers, and little old ladies in tennis shoes. They are bound together by an obsessive fear of communism, a word which they define to include any ideas differing from their own, even though these ideas may differ even more markedly with the ideas of Marx, Engels, Lenin, and Khrushchev. In response to this fear, they are willing to give up a large measure of the freedoms guaranteed them by the United States Constitution in favor of accepting the dictates of their founder. They seek, by means fair or foul, to force the rest of us to follow their example. They are pathetic. DJ Malloy points to a couple of interesting tensions arising out of this two-year period of intense scrutiny. The first is the question of their threat level. Which is it? Are they a menace, a creeping fascism that threatens the American democratic project? Or are they a bunch of paranoiac rubes aimlessly peeking under beds looking for baddies? The second tension is the treatment of Welch versus the members of the society, what he calls the tendency of its opponents to condemn vehemently the leaders of the society, especially Welch, while sympathizing with the frustrations and fears of its ordinary members. Then, in July of 1961, Robert announced the Files Project, which would compile a list of leading leftists who sought to merge the United States with the USSR and create a one-world communist government. He estimated that there were between 3 and 500,000 domestic communists worth keeping track of, and directed members to use one sheet of paper per commie with their name in the upper left corner of the page, followed by any relevant facts, backed up by direct quotations when possible. This would be sent in an envelope to JBS headquarters to be compiled into what Welch called the most complete, most accurate, and most useful file in America on the personnel of the whole liberal establishment. It's noteworthy here how Welch's language conflates the communist conspiracy with the liberal establishment, a rhetorical collapse that we see in the conservative movement today, much to the chagrin of actual communists. But the Files Project received mixed reactions, to say the least. A New York Times editorial worried that their little list would inevitably turn into a little blacklist, a true symptom of the totalitarian mindlessness that judges individuals by their class, their label, their category, not by what they are, what they say, or what they do. It wasn't just the liberal establishment that took issue with the project. Many JBS members themselves were disturbed by it, some to the point of resigning from the organization. Welch defended the endeavor by saying that it would not be published, and that the goal was not to make super-duper snoopers out of our members or put them spying on their neighbors. Rather, it was asking members to gather data from existing published sources, such as government documents and historical books. The Files Project underscored the fact that the JBS faced many of the same problems other political organizations struggle with: the spectrum of moderate to radical approaches. Members of the society began hoping that Welch would either soften his views or step down, Mannion included. He urged Welch to say that Eisenhower had unintentionally aided the communists, and hoped that he would gracefully retire into the editorial room. But Robert refused. In the event that Robert did resign, who might replace him? The more moderate JBS National Public Relations Director John Russolo was a good choice, or perhaps the more reactionary radio host Dan Smoot, depending on who you asked. Smoot believed that the communists weren't even the true origin of the cabal. That lay not in Moscow, but in the heart of the United States and the UN Council on Foreign Relations, which he called Washington's invisible government that was conditioning Americans to embrace socialism. His book, The Invisible Government, made the argument that communists were just a tool of a larger coterie of globalists and internationalists that ultimately traced back to the Illuminati. 1961 was a busy year for the JBS, and another controversy arose that would bring national attention to the radicalism of the society. This came in the form of General Edwin Walker. In 1956, an army report concluded that troops captured by North Korean forces had been insufficiently inoculated against communist propaganda, resulting in brainwashing and defection. The response was the implementation of right-wing military seminars across the country, made up of headlining speakers warning about the dangers of not just international communism, but domestic communism as well. In June of 1961, the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, J. William Fulbright, sent a memo to President Kennedy and Defense Secretary Robert McNamara, warning about the growing entanglements between the military and ultra-right movements in the U.S. The Kennedy administration, in its first few months, made it a priority to combat such right-wing indoctrination, and its primary target was General Edwin Walker. If Robert Welch was the Society's best-known member, Walker was its most controversial. Walker had implemented a pro-blue program in which troops were told to read militant, anti-communist right-wing literature, including Welch's The Life of John Birch. The program bore a striking resemblance to The Blue Book, and Walker was accused of trying to recruit for the JBS. American Opinion could be found at Army newsstands, with articles even being republished in the division's weekly paper, Tarot Leaf. Walker denied any connection, claiming that the program sought only to develop the understanding of American military and civil heritage, responsibility toward that heritage, and the facts and objectives of those enemies who would destroy it. The denial rang hollow. On April 17, 1961, Walker was relieved of command, and 2 months later he was admonished by the Army for committing injudicious actions, attacking leadership, and calling Harry Truman, Dean Acheson, and Eleanor Roosevelt definitely pink. The White House ordered an end to the pro-blue program. Walker resigned from the Army that fall and instantly became a martyr for the conservative cause with the likes of Douglas MacArthur. Birch Society member and California Republican Edgar Highstand said on the floor of the House of Representatives, "Since when is it proper procedure to relieve a military officer of his command for distributing the information of a patriotic society? Since when is it wrong to advance the cause of Americanism?" The entire affair was made as a result of the vicious attacks on the society in this country. Dale Alford, the conservative Democrat from Arkansas, shared his concerns. "Obviously, there is a conspiracy of harassment of all patriotic individuals and organizations." According to DJ Malloy, it was the reaction to Walker's punishment and the tensions within American society with respect to both political extremism and the relationship between the military and civilian society it encapsulated that make it such a revealing window into the United States at this time. Edwin Walker is a pretty interesting figure, and I'm going to go into a little more depth on his life and his political activism following the Pro Blue program in a supplemental episode, which you can hear at patreon.com/reactionpodcast. All of this combined led the Kennedy administration to change tack with regards to the JBS and the broader conservative movement. As Attorney General, Robert Kennedy ordered a memo to be drafted called the Ruther Memorandum, outlining how the government should handle the radical right. It focused on the JBS, as well as other anti-communist organizations, and argued that the right wing was better organized than at any time in recent history, and that their infiltration of the armed services adds in a new dimension to the seriousness with which they must be viewed. It counseled McNamara to fire anti-democracy generals, Robert Kennedy to build a list of subversives, the IRS to investigate tax-exempt statuses, and the FCC to revoke licenses. It also suggested that President Kennedy tamp down on the anti-communist rhetoric. This memo was, of course, further evidence for the JBS that this was a traitorous administration. Despite the attacks from mainstream political figures and the press, the right wing was on fire in 1962. But it was about to face a more formidable enemy than Time magazine or JFK's IRS itself. William F. Buckley had decided it was time to excommunicate Robert Welch from the conservative movement. He argued that Welch was diverting militant conservative action to irrelevance and ineffectuality. In one commentary, Buckley gave Welch quite the backhanded compliment. "There are, as we say, great things that need doing. The winning of a national election, the re-education of the governing class. John Birch chapters can do much to forward those aims, but only as they dissipate the fog of confusion that issues from Mr. Welch's smoking typewriter. Mr. Welch has revived in many men the spirit of patriotism, and that same spirit calls now for rejecting, out of love of truth and country, his false counsels." And so he went to the golden boy of the new conservatism, Barry Goldwater, for help. Buckley and other conservatives met with the Arizona senator to ask him to distance himself from the JBS, and Goldwater, despite believing that there were a lot of nice guys in the society, agreed that it would be best for it to either disband or see Welch resign. But Edward Miller argues that Buckley would win many battles, but Welch won the war. Despite the many calls from influential conservatives for him to step down, Welch retorted that resignation would be nothing less than a betrayal of the well-understood compact between our members and myself. Welch was deeply pained by Buckley's attacks, whom he had considered a friend. And he continued to praise National Review despite the schism, though he did issue his own backhanded compliment that the paper was more geared toward the academic side of conservatism rather than the rank and file of the movement. Buckley may have increasingly been seen as a member of the responsible right, but Miller goes on to argue that Buckley's statements on race and Africa and decolonialism were far more incendiary and racist than anything that Welch had ever said, and that the concept of a responsible right was a delusion itself. Buckley deemed the 14th and 15th Amendments to the Constitution illegitimate, designed to punish the South and make Black Americans equal, which was bad. He said that Africans would be ready to self-govern when they stop eating each other. He argued very straightforwardly in Why the South Must Prevail that the white community had the right to take measures to maintain its superiority because it was the more advanced race. For whatever his faults and foibles, Welch never said any such thing about race. Welch had his own criticisms of Buckley, namely that he was a silver-spooned hypocrite who had inherited everything he had, unlike himself. Buckley loved the limelight, and his standing as the respectable conservatism brought him a celebrity status. Soon enough, he had moved to the Upper East Side, hobnobbing with liberals at fancy ballroom parties. By the 1970s, Welch had even accused Buckley of being in on the conspiracy. He was officially the establishment. Miller makes a compelling point that the ostracization thesis, the notion that Buckley successfully drove Welch and the Birchers out of the conservative movement, has been exaggerated. Welch still had a great many followers and wielded tremendous influence. Miller writes, "Only after Buckley's death in 2008 and Donald Trump's victory in 2016 did his utter failure become clear. Robert Welch was never excommunicated from the conservative movement." Part of the proof of Welch's enormous influence was the fact that Nixon spent his entire 1962 campaign for governor of California attacking the JBS, which arguably contributed to his loss to Democrat Pat Brown. The alienated Birchers stayed home on Election Day. 1963 was a tumultuous year for the United States, especially with regards to the civil rights movement, always at the forefront of Welch's mind. Martin Luther King Jr. wrote his famous Letter from a Birmingham Jail, and protesters and police fought in the streets. These confrontations were false flags as far as Robert was concerned. Protesters would kick police dogs just seconds before the press photographed the snarling beasts. By now, Welch had given up hope that the Eisenhower letter could ever be successfully divorced from the JBS, and so he might as well sell it as a book. Thus, The Politician was formally born, with the charges against Eisenhower being subtly altered from him being part of the communist conspiracy to being part of the left-wing establishment. He also added more endnotes to give the book greater credibility. The JBS also published Earl Lively's book, The Invasion of Mississippi, which gave the Society's account of the role of communist agitators in the civil rights movement. This marked a larger shift in the Society to both publishing and focusing more on government overreach in race relations. Not all Birchers supported the pivot. National Council member Slobodan Draskovic called Welch's notion that the Birch Society is going to save America by getting people to read books absurd. The criticism fell on deaf ears, and by the end of the 1960s, the JBS operated more than 400 bookstores. One of their most valuable authors was Manning Johnson, a leading black conservative who brought an air of, see, we're not racist, legitimacy to the Society's kooky arguments about communist infiltration of the civil rights movement. A former member of the Communist Party, Johnson turned on his comrades and testified before the HUAC that the CPUSA was establishing a Negro Republic in the South, in line with Lenin's program to establish self-governing national minorities. His 1958 book, Color, Communism, and Common Sense, argued that integration was destroying the progress being made in race relations, which Welch had long argued. The JBS later reprinted the book. Johnson was killed in a car accident in 1959, which many Birchers believed to be an assassination, perhaps by the Soviets. Add another martyr to the list. To some extent, Johnson's race helped the JBS to distance itself from white supremacy. But Miller argues that many Birchers were horrified by King's image of black and white children walking hand in hand. Welch didn't agree with the racist pseudoscience on genetic intelligence that often bolstered such prejudices. Unlike Draskovich's apocalyptic visions of the mongrelization of Western civilization, Welch didn't believe the racial order of the South was natural or desirable. He opposed civil rights simply because it was government overreach. But not everyone in the JBS felt the same way, and JBS chapters were even segregated based on race, with, believe it or not, all Black chapters existing in the organization. Things could have gone very differently for the Society had Draskovich had his way. He teamed up with his fellow racist Revelo Oliver to try to oust Welch from the JBS. Eventually, Welch fired Oliver over his anti-Semitism, stating that his anti-Semitic feelings are probably as strong as those of anybody in America. Though the attempted coup may have had as much to do with the firing as anything else. Welch also accused Los Angeles Council member Paul H. Talbert of leading the charge to remove him in 1961. Mannion was also not happy with Robert's leadership, especially his steadfast commitment to keeping the JBS an educational organization. Mannion believed that the Society had to move toward being a more action-oriented movement, and that education does not suffice to defeat a conspiracy. All of this left Welch wondering whom he could trust, leading him to hire sycophants and die-hard loyalists. Welch was thin-skinned and heavily invested in being the smartest guy in the room, and he surrounded himself with, often incompetent, kowtowers. Miller argues that the more semi-incompetence he hired, the further the Society fell. One such example was Tom Hill, director of field activities. American opinion writer Gary Allen remarked that every creative idea which would help build the Birch Society died on Tom Hill's desk, and that he stifles creativity and activity. Allen went so far as to speculate that Hill was a plant, a mole sent into the Society to impede its progress. Then, in November of 1963, one of the most shocking events of the 20th century occurred, the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. Many believed the JBS may have been involved. At the Phoenix office, a gunman fired two shots into the building, shouting, "You killed my man!" Welch received menacing phone calls. The headquarters in Belmont was surrounded by protesters, as was the Society's building in L.A. A brick was thrown through Welch's office window. He canceled the Society's fifth anniversary dinner that weekend. It seemed obvious to much of the public that the far right had been responsible for the assassination. In response, Welch took out a full-page ad claiming that communism killed Kennedy in the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the Chicago Tribune, highlighting Oswald's connections to the Soviet Union and Cuba. Meanwhile, more anti-Semitism. Westbrook Pegler, anti-civil rights activist and member of a white supremacist White Citizens Council, wrote a blatantly anti-Semitic tract for American Opinion. The article was supposed to be a factual overview of the rise of the labor movement, but according to Welch, these directions lasted for about three paragraphs, and Pegler went off worse than ever into the very kind of hate-mongering that is so contrary to the spirit of the Society, and so dangerously destructive of what we are trying to do. Welch was in California at the time and unable to stop the printing, but his loyal secretary, Miss Lovett, managed to keep the December issue from being mailed to subscribers. The Society lost $15,000 on the endeavor. Pegler was eventually expelled from the Society, and members of White Citizens Councils were barred from entry into the JBS, at least as policy, if not practice. By 1963, Goldwater was beginning to have a change of heart about running for president. The draft Goldwater Committee held its first press conference that year, established chairs in 33 states, and drummed up a great deal of nationwide support. But the assassination cast a shadow over his campaign, leading many to paint him as a trigger-happy extremist who was part of the broader movement responsible for Kennedy's death. Welch supported Goldwater himself, but remained committed to keeping the Society an educational entity, not a political one. This much to the displeasure of many JBS members. Nevertheless, members of the Society and grassroots right-wing activists were central to Goldwater's campaign. Goldwater never got around to publicly condemning the Society so as not to alienate these critical supporters. And as Miller points out, Goldwater's political views certainly lined up with many of the Birchers. He had a narrow view of the Constitution and judicial authority. He opposed the civil rights movement and Brown v. Board. He went so far as to call Birchers the finest people in this community. But there was a concern about Goldwater coming off as an extremist, so campaign advisors generally tried to keep birchers at arm's length, implementing a sort of don't ask, don't tell policy with regards to volunteers and surrogates. At the same time, birchers were increasingly discreet about their own affiliation with the org. The former States' Rights Party candidate for the presidency and co-founder of the society, Coleman Andrews, said of the Goldwater campaign, "I have been told right straight out that they don't want the cooperation of any official of the John Birch Society except on a very quiet basis." But hiding their tryst with the JBS wasn't enough to secure a win for Goldwater. Lyndon Baines Johnson won the 1964 presidential election handily. LBJ was a Bircher's worst nightmare. His Great Society and War on Poverty projects were the epitome of the Eastern Establishment communist conspiracy to world domination. He signed into law the dreaded Civil Rights Act. Johnson passed laws on Medicare, the horrifying National Endowments for the Arts and Humanities, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. And there were a few controversies with these programs, specifically the Black Arts Repertory Theater in Harlem. Founded by the Black nationalist Leroy Jones, the theater spent $115,000 in government funds on a play about a Black chauffeur killing white people. Of course, Welch didn't acknowledge the fact that the FBI was closely monitoring and infiltrating the Repertory Theater, and it certainly wouldn't be the first or last time the government spent resources on an outfit they planned to entrap. But to the JBS, this was just further proof of the conspiracy. There was also the Blackstone Rangers, a violent street gang in Chicago that allegedly misused government jobs meant for job training. The Rangers' ties with ultimate boogeyman Saul Alinsky further inflamed JBS outrage. The whole incident was used to humiliate the Johnson administration and highlight the abuse of these government programs. The pendulum seemed to be swinging in the wrong direction. The Eastern Establishment and communist conspiracy was becoming stronger with each passing day. The turmoil of the civil rights movement, and soon the feminist movement, was throwing the nation into chaos and turning citizens against each other at a time when they should be uniting in the name of Americanism and patriotism. America was, it seemed, less and less a country of values and immortal moral codes. And things were about to get worse, much to the benefit of the John Birch Society. Thanks for listening to this episode of Reaction. If you like the show, please rate and review it. And consider supporting my work by visiting patreon.com/reactionpodcast. There you can find all the episode scripts, as well as bonus audio content that supplements the main episodes. Follow the show on Twitter @ReactionPodcast for episode updates, and send your questions or feedback to reactionpod@gmail.com. This show is written and produced by me, Brittany Gill. Until next time.